You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the afternoon of October 9th, 1984. Miles upon miles of flat or hilly plains formed Sojatilia, wide open space with many densely populated pockets such as its second largest, Bahia Rojo. At its shore, the city was a hotspot for surfing, boating, and volleyball, but inland, it was a polis of glass facades and brutal concrete. Balancing the architecture that defined Bahia Rojo, Xochitl, Marañón Preparatory was a middle and high school for the rich and well-connected. 4 in the afternoon meant that its students were dismissed to head for home or the dormitories, and Aleja was one of the kids eager to leave campus. She walked the bumpy, fissured twists and turns of a way out frequented by almost no one, hoping to not run into 3 girls who've been bullying her. The school's exit in sight, Aleja took a laughy, happy deep breath and walked toward it with a determination as perfect as her grades. Upon her walk's 6th step, Bertie Montez and Zanvia Bustillos leapt out of the surrounding brush and tackled her, holding her as Irene Brosnan emerged from said undergrowth. Aleja, dismayed over being found, asking herself how those 3 could have known that she would try to sneak out the way she did. Irene lip-licked her appreciation of the effort made to avoid her, Bertie and Zanfia, for it proved how respected and feared they were. Aleja was too shaken up to tell the 3 that what she felt was all fear and no respect, pleading for someone somewhere to help her. Bertie encouraged her to yell until her larynx degraded to raw mush, calling it futile as they were far away from any unsuspecting cochlear. Zanfia dared Aleja to scream again and chuckled when she did with every ounce of her sound, saying it was proof that she was truly alone. Irene hoped her lackeys were starving for bromelian with Xochitlian on the side, moving her fists like she had a fork in one hand and knife on the other. At a glass condo looking down at the beach, Hambleton III was at his home office desk reading a handwritten letter that brought a smile to his face. He said Aleja will be absolutely thrilled when she gets home, seeing the fruits of a tree he spent months caring for finally be ready. What pleased Hambleton almost as much was reading on the paper that Habsburgo V was expected to defeat Gregorio Jr. in a popular vote landslide. He then turned to the page that asked the reader if they've seen Mauricia, Marcos, or Catalpa, dimming his happiness by a quarter. Hambleton felt horrible for his sister, but nothing in the way of love or respect after everything she did, having no desire to meet her again or even reestablish any kind of contact with her. His ill will for Mauricia was non-existent, but he still thought that she should have foresaw what life had in store for her. A grating buzz of the doorbell preceded a receptionist's need for Hambleton to come to the front lobby because Aleja was in a terrible way. The horror he felt emitting from the old lady's voice proved to him that something horrible happened to his daughter, hustling him into rushing out of his condo and to where she was 11 stories below. Throughout the dart down, Hambleton's brain registered each passing second as an hour, and his heart sank when he finally got to the lobby. Having employees and witnesses all around her, Aleja was sort of prone on the floor, looking like she had been scratched up by a lion and had a boxer have his bruising way with her for 12 rounds. The concern all over Hambleton enfeebled her into crawling to him like an infant trying to run, causing them to hug with an intensity not felt in a long time. He didn't give a darn about Aleja's blood staining his $2,400 suit, asking her if those three girls beat her again. When she nodded, Hambleton let go of her and she saw him grab the lobby's desk phone to call the police, telling the operator that he'd like to report a battery. Aleja viewed the police's arrival as her chance to get Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia the hell out of her life so that she could move on with her own. That night, the girls who beat her were arrested right after they walked out of a beauty supply store and got caught with unpurchased lipsticks and hairsprays in their purses. Police booked them on charges of aggravated battery, harassment, shoplifting, resisting arrest, and assault on an officer. Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia took turns calling their parents to inform them of their arrest and the crimes they were accused of committing. The girls denied doing anything wrong, going as far as calling Aleja an unhinged liar known for hurting herself on purpose to get sympathy out of others. As off the cuff their denials were, it was enough to convince their parents to bail them out of having to spend a night in juvenile detention. Aleja went to sleep after an evening of a painful wound care that led to the discovery that her injuries weren't as severe as they appeared. This did little to build her psyche out of the tatters that it was in, leading Hambleton to make the decision of letting her stay at home for the rest of the school week. As Aleja slept in the next day, he realized that he never showed her the letter, getting it in hopes of bringing some happiness to her life. It wasn't until 3 that afternoon when she garnered the strength to freshen up and get dressed for what was left of the day. For Aleja, seeing herself on the mend was like being helped up by a light tasked with freeing her of the darkness, constricting her, turning her feeble frown into a grin as easy to break as a thin crystal glass cup. Walking down the hall, she bumped into Hambleton, who was on his way to her room, and asked what he had in his hand. He said he was aware of how rough things have been for her as of late because of Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia, adding that he was as sick and tired of their cruelty as she was. Hambleton promised to surprise Aleja with something superb for her birthday yesterday, but couldn't reveal it because of the incident. He instructed her to take the letter, saying that to read it would be like unwrapping her gift to her from him. Aleja learned that Hambleton had adopted Meadow Seneceros, a girl her age who aspired to be someone's big sibling and protector by extension. She fell to her knees, covered her mouth, screamed, and panted with a joy heavy enough to almost make her pass out. Aleja cried like a baby seeing its parents for the first time, shedding tears sweeter than sugar and giving Hambleton one of the brightest looks he's ever seen her have. She leapt up, hugged her father, thanked him so very much for doing that, and asked him when and where they were to take Meadow in. The morning of October 12th was another typical Friday for Xochitl City International Airport, fully staffed and busier than heck. Anxiety flowed through Hamilton and Aleja's veins like blood cells as they waited 6 hours for the flight from Central Brumel Lake to arrive. This unease resulted from her wondering what she got herself into and whether he was really up to the task of caring for another teenager. At 4:15 p.m., the call of the flight's arrival came, having them jog to the greeting area as its 142 passengers began walking down the stairs. It wasn't long before Hamilton and Aleja saw a teenage girl in her yellow rose sandals and dress holding her equally flowery bags. The two didn't need to see her short blonde French braid and beautifully wholesome face to know that the teen was indeed Meadow. And when she laid eyes on Hamilton and Aleja, out cracked a smile and say of hello to her dear, benevolent father and precious angelic sister. Father and daughter departed the airport with a calmness high on its hope for a long, successful life with their new family member. Hamilton, Aleja, and Meadow went to a hole-in-the-wall taqueria not far from the airport for an early dinner meant to get them comfortable with being together. Since it was after lunch and before dinner, the restaurant wasn't busy letting the jukebox play its mariachi heart out mostly unchallenged. Wanted by Hamilton to tell him and Aleja her story, Meadow gave them a look blanker than a piece of paper, making her new stepfather wish he hadn't asked her that. Aleja apologized to her stepsister for what their dad wanted her to do and said she didn't have to and shouldn't tell if she wasn't ready. As 3 orders worth of tacos were being made, Meadow told her that she had nothing to say sorry about and assured Hamilton that what he said was okay. She urged Aleja and her dad not to start talking about something else because telling who she was and where she came from was a must. Meadow was born in Stotliu, Arkansas, a natural wonder in the form of a town near the state's border with Louisiana, hence her southern accent. Priding itself in being Mother Nature's melting pot, her place of birth had no shortage of common and rare plant and animal life. Meadow equated living in Stotliu to a magical wonderland where dreams came true, happiness was law, and incivility wasn't tolerated. One fable dear to her was the one about the hare and the tortoise because it taught her that physical prowess stood no chance against mental determination. Hamilton wasn't sure if he agreed with that interpretation, and Aleja had no memory of arriving at such a moral. In the interest of avoiding conflict, neither of them challenged Meadow to specify what in the fable led her to the message that she got. Hamilton felt that in the often zany world of literature, everyone was entitled to their opinion, and Aleja didn't want to do anything that could strain her relationship with someone she was desperate to have in her corner. Meadow wanted to enchant them with every single adventure she went on growing up, but said it was best to unveil such stories one at a time. Asked by Hamilton how she wound up in Central Brumel Lake, she tried to answer, but the great pain it brought twisted her thoughts into a pretzel. He was incredibly sorry for asking her that and said that perhaps now wasn't ideal for revelations apologizing again for wanting a lot revealed so soon. Meadow thanked Hambleton for his second apology and accepted it with a firm grin as a waitress served them and Aleja their plates of tacos. Eating gave those three some time to gather their thoughts and look forward to a multi-day agenda planned weeks in advance. Hambleton plopped a bundle of ones into a tip jar and Meadow topped that with a single bill four times as valuable and told the help that they were welcome. Aleja declined to tip and handed the waitress a note urging her and her colleagues to strike for higher wages. The help thought that her urge was condescending but kept that angst inside, fearing that she'd have them fired if they called her out. Their supervisor thanked Aleja, Hambleton, and Meadow for their patronage and hoped that the food and service was to their liking. The help looked at him like he spent his whole shift in his office yet again, folding and sliding the note under the cash register for one of them to take later. Driving away from Xochitl City and toward Bahia Rojo, Hambleton asked Meadow if she'd be up for a stroll through one of Xochitlia's five enchanted parks, enticing her to respond with an inability to see why she wouldn't, as warm and calm as the late afternoon sun. Covering all but the edges of a flat valley, Kaluela Fields was a preserve for some of the world's rarest flowers and where visitors could feel like they're in heaven. Metal fences kept the public on the well-maintained dirt walking paths and away from blossoms that could be found nowhere else on Earth. For Meadow, arriving at the fields happied her into exhaling a huzzah that finally saw the end of being strapped to a seat for way too long. Hambleton pulled up to an entrance booth and was allowed to pass after paying $13 and signing a promise not to deface or steal from the park. He parked at the field's northeast lot, one of four with southeast, southwest, and northwest being the other three, adding distended corners to a circle with the jaggedness of barbed wire. Hambleton and Aleja looked around as if they were familiar with the park, but were intent on exploring a bit of the lion's share of what they've yet to behold. Meadow whispered a wow and shook her head at how she was so close to a rainbow she swore only existed in fables, telling her father and sister that this walk will be one to remember. 8 steps into their stroll, they came across a small patch of dark purple teal dahlias that a stone plate identified as amethylias, known for tasting like eggplants and having a minty smell. Meadow wanted to pluck one of the flowers for her scrapbook, but Hambleton slapped her wrist, asking her if she was trying to get them, and Aleja kicked out. That slap broke the chains restraining a personal demon 4 years younger than her, agitating her into almost slapping the taste out of her stepfather's mouth. Hambleton gripped Meadow's left hand before it could hit his nose and upper lip, constricting it into a ball smaller than his fist. She whispered uncle as if she was screaming, while Aleja quietly begged him to let go of her because he was hurting her for real. Hambleton demanded that Meadow apologize for the slap he was sure would have been strong enough to fatten his lip and crunch his nose in. Aleha begged her sister to say sorry for the good of their family and told her that if she did, they and their father will forget that this insanity ever happened. That got Meadow to apologize her heart out, which calmed Hambleton into releasing his grip on her hand and asking the girls if they shall move on. The next 100 yards of their stroll banished any thoughts of that spat to the realm of matters that mustn't ever be brought up. They walked past other people and families that looked at them like they were just 3 more guests eager to experience the fields. The spat Meadow had with Hambleton was so quiet that you had to see it or be inches from it to know that it happened, and their car was the only one parked in the northeast lot at that time of that day. Aleha remembered being more out of control than that when her father first adopted her 10.5 years earlier. Hambleton gave the partly cloudy sky a glance that asked it not to tell him that he's gotta raise another one after the hell of a time he had with the first. He pinned his hopes on not struggling as much with parenting Meadow than he did with Aleha, assuring himself that the former was more sure of herself than the latter was. 89 yards further into the fields, Hambleton spotted a tall patch that encouraged visitors to pose and take pictures. Aleha handed him the photo camera, jogged into the flowers, sat down, laid on her back, had her arms out, and pushed out her onyx hair. Hambleton took a picture of her smiling and blending in somewhat with the black, white-cord diashias known for being as comfy as pillows but tougher than shoe leather, witty koras. This made it one of the few species of flower that guests were allowed to touch, step, or rest on all they wanted but not take. Meadow spotted a second patch 10 yards further in the fields, but of thornless orange-red roses with petals covering its sunflower-like stems. Known as roeorons, the flowers were as imposing and beautiful as they were mysterious, gathering behind a stone plate, telling onlookers that they may gaze to their heart's content, but not touch. Tickled by a want to be funny, Meadow promised Hambleton that she won't be touching anything she shouldn't this time, rubbing him the wrong way. She told him to never mind that, had her back face him, grabbed her dress's hips, turned her face toward him, looked down with a grinning frown, and said she was ready for a picture. As Hambleton flashed a photo, Aleha envied how majestic Meadow looked, but silenced it, understanding that her sister was her key to humbling Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia to the hilt. The switching on of the lights around the fields' paths signaled the arrival of dusk, and it was the three's cue to move their stroll along. Hambleton, Aleha, and Meadow reached the core of the fields, beholding what remained of the Kaluela Castle, the former residence of Xochitl Marañón, Xochitlia's first and longest reigning ruler. Decades of being one with nature enveloped the castle in a hyacinth mantle of the black, maroon, and white that colored the nation's flag. Something about it bludgeoned Meadow with a club that splashed a harrowing memory all over her face, paling her into sprinting toward it as Aleha and Hambleton froze as if they heard a gun go off. In spite of its destruction and decay, the interior that wasn't touched was as impressive, alive, and colorful as the fields' flowers. When Meadow reached the ballroom, her knees and feet gave out and she fell, hitting her forehead and crashing on her palms and toes. Aleha and Hambleton caught up to her and were sickened by her wailing like her life was being sucked out of her body. Reliving how her life in Stotliu ended, Meadow begged for that chapter to leave her alone and never come back, screaming that it had nothing to do with who she was presently. Hambleton's wonder of what she meant by that snapped her out of her woe, showing him a stunned, teary-eyed look back he was disturbed by. It took Meadow 25 silent seconds to hatch out of her astonishment, whispering that what she remembered was too barbarous to talk about in public. All she was willing to say was that what she relived happened when she was younger, admitting that it was largely responsible for her move from Stotliu to central Brumel Lake. Hambleton respected her choice not to tell more, but at the same time, his suspicion of her was now at his mind's steering wheel. Of course, he hid this from her, and his suggestion that they and Aleha head for home was one thing they could agree on. Hambleton needed to be alone in his office for a minute, a front, to tell Meadow that she hadn't fooled him for a second and will learn everything about her if it's the last thing he does. What he suspected was that she did, took part in, or was forced to do things that ran her out of Stotliu, but didn't know what those actions were. Hambleton asked himself how likely that was to have been the case, concluding that someone like Meadow didn't have the bones or stomach necessary to perpetrate anything malicious. He believed that the likelihood of her being a victim or witness of such actions was much higher, making him wonder about the Central Bell Initiative. Hambleton would have liked to have been made aware of Meadow's mood swings, having him think about what else the adoption agency was hiding from him and other adopters. Meadow looked around her new bedroom, breathed, felt, and tasted its quiet warmth, and couldn't wait to decorate it with every desirable aspect of her identity. Aleha knocked on the door and asked if she could come in, and she did, after being told to please do. She told Meadow that she had something to confide in her as well, and so what followed was a story about her years of being bullied by Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia. A fortress of metal surrounded by glass skyscrapers, the Bahia Rojo jail was that darkness in the light. One at a time, adults were booked into its eastern half, while the western one was where juveniles like Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia were processed. Unlike the majority of kids their age, however, the girls were in a relatively high security unit that housed minors awaiting judicial waiver hearings. The very real possibility of being charged as adults had Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia on edge and bleating like toddlers for their parents to get them out. What made their situation ache more was the radio program playing out of the speakers nailed to the ceilings of their jail cells. It was Xochitlia's then-president Fleming Dimas quoting proverbs about straight paths, unshaken hope, and walks through shadow valleys. To Irene, hearing him read scripture was like hearing nails run down a chalkboard, but she listened on, hoping to get something out of it. Birdie told Dimas to shut up so many times that it got loud enough for one of the guards to tell her to keep it down in the name of the Lord, which she reacted to with a whisper for her to F the hell off. Xanthia mentally got lost in the scripture being read, looking like a kid staring at the stars via a window with a want to escape the two imprisoning her. She saw Irene and Birdie as those captors, keeping her from pursuing her goal of exploring every quarter of the world. Xanthia would abandon them on a whim, but her fear of them pursuing her to the ends of the earth kept her in their orbit. She didn't regret bullying Aleha because of her belief that she was no saint, and could attest to that, thinking that what she helped Irene and Birdie do wasn't without provocation. Xanthia told God that if he blessed her with a second chance, she'll run away and find herself, stop being a bully, and never hurt anyone again. The guard returned from a bathroom break to inform her, Irene, and Birdie that they were free to go, even though she felt that they deserved to rot like milk in the heat. She said the charges filed by Hambleton, the store's staff, and arresting officers have all been dropped, calling them lucky, as she unlocked their cells and escorted them to the discharge area. Irene was glad her parents came through, couldn't thank them enough, felt like she owed them one, and vowed to never get arrested again. Birdie processed being bailed out as a benefit she was entitled to, had no plans to repay her mother or father, and thought it was their responsibility to utilize every resource in their disposal to keep her free. She and Irene were excited about getting back to school so that their bullying of Aleha could continue, and could almost taste her agony. Xanthia's time in jail scarred her into understanding that it was all she'll see if she kept associating with them, visualizing a checklist of everything she must do to make her run from her old life successful. When she, Irene, and Birdie saw their respective rides arrive, they brisked outside, got in the cars, and were all smiles now that they and their parents have reunited. In spite of everything the girls did, the car rides weren't befouled by disgust, resentment, anger, hatred, disappointment, or even discomfort. A store dropping shoplifting charges was baffling to Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia, but what really puzzled them was Hambleton and the officers they assaulted doing the same. Be that as it may, all the girls could think about was one date, October 15th, 1984, the day they and Aleha were to return to school. And when the sun rose that morning, Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia stormed in like they always did, but their haughty walk halted at the sight of their favorite target being shoulder to shoulder with Meadow. Aleha didn't show her bullies the dread they got to know and love, but rather the look of a spine tougher than tungsten. Neither she nor Meadow appeared to have rested well in the last few days, and that was due to how sour their stomachs had gotten after learning of the dropped charges. Hambleton's excuse for what he did manifested itself as an arrangement he made with the store's staff and arresting officers, refusing to divulge what it entailed. He was a believer in Fleming's emphasis on rehabilitation over punishment, saying that there's a lot more hurt involved in correcting someone. Hambleton added that beyond his reason, he felt that locking Irene Birdie and Xanthia away wouldn't teach them not to bully Aleha or anyone else. His worry was the conflict between the girls and his daughters evolving into something far more dangerous years down the line. Hambleton was tempted to tell Aleha and Meadow everything Mauricia did, but opted not to, as it risked painting him in a not-so-flattering light. He wanted his first daughter to stop getting hurt and didn't want his second one to experience that pain for herself. As Aleha and Meadow were staring Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia down, Hambleton's arrangement was coming together one puzzle piece at a time, beginning to reveal something profound. At the Sojitelia presidential house, Fleming was fresh out of a Bible study he held with immediate and extended family. The article he read predicted that Habsburger V would defeat Gregorio Jr. in the upcoming presidential election in a historical landslide. That brought a smile to his face and reassured him that the Bromelians will embrace the angels of love and hope and reject the demons peddling hate and despair. Fleming was confident that the imminent historical election defeat will humble Gregorio into rethinking his angry, hateful ways. His wish was for the Bromelian People's Party to let what was coming be their push to step off the path they've been on since the 60s. Six big men in all black walked into the school like robots, sticking out like sore thumbs to every student and their friend. They grabbed, handcuffed, and assured Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia that they weren't under arrest, but were going to a place where delinquents like them go to have God cleanse them of their evil and dishonesty. Aleha's hand covering of her wide-opened mouth underscored how out of nowhere that custody take and takeaway were. Meadow and the students who saw it shared in her shock, then breathed a sigh of relief, realizing that the three little terrors were now gone. They cheered, clapped, whistled, and Aleha was told by many that it was over at long, long last, getting hugs and smiles like she never did before. Meadow hugged her sister and said that their dad did it, and asked her why her face was still long when it ought to be smiling like a dog jumping at raining tennis balls. Aleha said no words could even begin to describe how effing elated she was right now, thanking and apologizing to Hambleton. She still doubted that a boot camp will reform three girls who were as far gone as Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia were, but felt it was better than doing nothing. Aleha wasn't a big fan of Fleming's doctrine of restoration over retribution, but was willing to give it a chance. Meadow knew little about Sojitelia's current president, but could tell just by looking at the picture Hambleton had of him at the house that he feared God. Aleha told her that with Irene, Birdie, and Xanthia no longer in the picture, they could now finish high school, go to college, graduate, get good jobs, start families, happily grow old, and die fulfilled. Meadow thought that was incredibly worldly of her to say, having never thought that, but said that the sky's the limit and the world was now in front of them. The next 26 days were a shuffling cycle of learning as one, hanging out like one brood, and seeing a horizon with no hateful or terrifying boundaries. But on November 12th, students woke up to Fleming mandating that all schools cancel classes for the day. He said this mandate was in response to the sinful coup d'etat in Bromelia, supplicating Sojitelians to pray for their Bromelian brothers and sisters. Aleha shrieked a gasp with a pitch as high as a mouse. Hambleton couldn't mouth, let alone speak, and metal shook like her skin was lighter than an old leaf. Fleming said, as of now, there was no invasion or threat thereof, pleading with Sojatilians to not scratch the itchy urge to panic. He let Sojatilians know that his administration was working around the clock to better understand what happened on the 10th and 11th. Fleming announced that he'll make an effort to contact Gregorio and see what the sin-filled leader had to say for himself. His want was to get that sinner to return the power he stole or have him promise in writing not to expand his rule beyond Bromelia or be unmerciful to the Bromelian people. Hambleton facepalmed at how naive Fleming sounded. Aleha hummed with a hopefulness that watched its step, and Meadow felt ashamed to be herself. A ring of the doorbell cut the reacting short, had them gather around the door and open it to a Pruss blue robin sitting on the welcome mat holding a tiny scroll with its mouth. Hambleton wondered why a bird like that would be at his doorstep, but Aleha was caught up in observing its wondrous feather coat. But Meadow stared at the robin as if it had come from Stotliu to destroy her, being unable to look away as it gazed at her like she was its mother. His suspicion switched on. Hambleton tried taking the scroll, but the bird took four steps back and hissed like a ticked off cat. He wanted Meadow to take its darn paper, as it was obvious to him that it was for her, declaring that as an order. When she complied, Hambleton reached for the paper and she refused to unhand it, irking him into telling her to let it go at once. Meadow remembered the blood she pushed out of her index finger and dripped into the robin's mouth before a crowd of people in scrubs. She yelled that she couldn't let Hambleton see that because the scroll was for her eyes only, and babyishly besought him to understand that. That told Hambleton that he too had to conceal things from other people at one point, disarming him into relenting and letting Meadow read it without him or Aleha having a peek. The three went back inside as the robin screeched like a vinyl record getting scratched across by a stylus, stomping its feet and flapping its wings in anger. Meadow unrolled the scroll to ask for her to declare her assimilation with drips of blood, shaking because it was another reminder of her former loyalty to the Yellow Cross. She crumpled the paper, walked to the kitchen, threw it in the trash, and thought she got rid of the last remnant of her old ways. Meadow understood that the robin will eventually fly away to its sender, empty-handed, or remain until it dies of starvation and dehydration. She fought that sense the bird was unable to talk. It couldn't rat her out, lulling her into sighing her huzzah over finally being free. Meadow's apology to Hambleton and Aleha for how childishly she acted was met with the kind of forgiving hug Fleming would give. Hours after, Alaret Sr. told Gregorio of how better Operation Central Bell was faring. He was informed by the project's leader, Alberta, that one subject didn't declare. He reproved her for not telling him before the call, but still he wanted to know who that vile brat was. When Alured heard the name Meadow Ceniceros, he told Alberta that she should begin to redeem herself by dealing with the non-declarer. Ullrich said that Lady Luck blessed her today, but warned her not to engage in any future deception, or it will be the whip, cage, or even wall for her, ordering her to leave his suite before she could swear to anything. Normally married to her inferiors, Alberta's focused return to her office was her message to them that they were about to work very hard. And as fate would have it, the subjects who did declare would gladly embrace the extra labor, especially those residing in Bahia Rojo. And that was Central Bell. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.